No, El Jefe, you tell me when we need to shut up and drink, as the anti-federalists want to do. But I'm willing to take all kinds of questions until such time as we're told not to. Yes.
I come with unclean arms.
You got unclean arms?
Unclean arms. I'm a mayor of a small village, so I like local government. I like the anti-federalists. But I also have the Federalist Papers. I think it was in Hamilton, in Federalist 68, where they defended the Electoral College as being, if not...
First question. Stay behind the podium, Lloyd. Don't wander. The first comment on the Electoral College is that if you go back to the founding, the only person who sees an independent, that I've managed to discover, that sees some kind of independent role for these electors in the Electoral College is Hamilton. And it's very unfortunate that Madison didn't have a say in the presidential and Senate and judicial papers. The last one he wrote was 63, and that's because he had to go back to Virginia from New York because Patrick Henry had passed a law saying that you couldn't run for the Virginia ratifying convention unless you were a resident. So the entire executive and entire judicial papers are written by Hamilton. And so if you... so you're going to read the highest toned that is possible on the Federalist perspective. Most authors at the founding, and I think most, I would argue, ought to most, don't see that the Electoral College as critical because of the independent vote it might give to these electors. The critical thing is where do the states fit in? And through the convention, and that the people who objected to the role of the states were people like Madison and Gouverneur Morris, etc. The key, in my opinion, to the Electoral College is to recognize that we're electing a president of the United States and not a president of America. Okay? And that is the key battle. So I wouldn't get trapped in Hamilton's argument. That Hamilton's argument for this independent but such and such, and who is this person who's going to vote for Mickey Mouse, and who is this, all kinds of things, is just throwing us off the main sort of the main track. And the main track is, where do the states fit in, and are the states critical? And that is what we need to be asking. To what extent are the states in the 21st century still an important and vital part of the American experiment, or can we now do away with them? And if we're going to do away with them, we ought to understand that and amend the Constitution accordingly, which we have. And interestingly, the states have gone along. I mean, think about it. This is why I have problems with some of my conservative friends who say that the progressive hijacked the Constitution, because through the 17th Amendment, was done by two-thirds of the House, two-thirds of the Senate, which is controlled by the states, and three-quarters of the states themselves. I mean, that is some corruption. I don't know about hijacking. It may be thorough corruption of the electorate that these states willingly gave that up. So my response to you about the Electoral College is spend less time on the specific electors in Hamilton and more time on the fact that the states are the critical part of it. And that this critique which we constantly face about the Electoral College being undemocratic is missing the point. You know, it's not a question of undemocratic, it's a question of pro-federal. And if we don't want it, we can do away with it. But don't end run. I mean, the number of states right now are trying to do these interstate compact end runs is just disgusting. We just go out and do it. I mean, just end the Electoral College if that's what you're opposed to. But the problem is that somehow they still think that by becoming more national, you become more democratic. And that's the warning of the anti-federalists, that you've got to retain that localism or that regionalism. The other comment, what was the second point?
The Tenth Amendment.
You know, I think a sensible, I think that even the most rabid anti-federalists would agree that you've got to have a sensible understanding between the Interstate Commerce Clause and the 10th Amendment. I mean, but then the question becomes, where do we get our sense from? And how do we, you know, and that comes from civic education. For example, I mean, one could argue that, you know, Article 1, Section 8 says that that Congress has the power to regulate the Army and the Navy, but not the Air Force. And Article 2 gives, well, see, look, I'm telling you, if the Founding Fathers wanted to have the Congress be in charge of regulating the Air Force, they would have put it in there. And it's people like you, madam, who take these quick, easy routes. Today, the Air Force, tomorrow, No Child Left Behind Act. That's the slippery slope, see? You say we don't need anti-federalism? For example, Article 2 says the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy. It doesn't say Commander-in-Chief of the Air Force. But you know the good old American way is, you know how the Air Force came in, don't you? Army Air Corps. Think about the American mind. Isn't that an incredibly wonderful mind to join things together, what other countries rent asunder? You just say, well, we'll fix it. It's obviously part of the Army, isn't it? You do it, so it passes. The next thing, like education, Sputnik is in the 50th year, right? What about Sputnik? There's the National Defense Student Loan. That's how we, right? Remember that, NDSL? You know what it's called now? It's called National Direct Student Loan. It used to be called National Defense Student Loan. Why? Because Congress has control over national defense. Didn't have any power to do student loans. But now we don't care anymore. The American mind has come used to the notion of NDSL. 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 We don't have to worry about what the D stands for. So there's a reasonable way, it seems to me, to interpret this. And that in the case of an Air Force, it seems to me reasonable to say that Army, Navy, right, add Air Force. But on the other hand, you see, I think that a lot of the problem comes from John Marshall in McCulloch versus Maryland, with this whole understanding of the necessary and proper clause. I mean, there are lots I could talk about there, but I'll just mention one thing. James Madison said that he agreed with Marshall's decision, but didn't agree with his opinion. And the reason why I agreed with his decision was that through time, from 1787 on, the meaning had been liquidated, that people had understood that this was part of the fabric now that the U.S. could have a bank. The reason why he didn't agree with his opinion is that Marshall's opinion defining what necessary and proper was, Madison said, you couldn't find one person adopting Marshall's opinion in 1787. Not even Hamilton. And so Madison's problem is not with the decision, but with the opinion. Why? Because according to Madison, once opinion gets stuck in the American mind, it is incredibly difficult to dislodge. And that constitutionality is not simply about the words in the Constitution, but about the opinions that the public have about what constitutional morality is. And that saps a certain understanding of the infrastructure. In other words, what happens to civic education? That was the end of that answer to that question. So I'm yes. Yes. Go ahead.
I'm deeply sympathetic with everything you've said so far.
But
sentiment and prejudice, but I have a theoretical sort of problem. And
okay.
That is essentially why states. You alluded to the fact that Calhoun is often seen as a direct inheritor of the anti-federalist tradition, and actually modern leftists have taken up Calhoun's theory, and there are leftist theories of concurrent majorities that say, well, yes, we should have a federalism, but it should be a federalism based on race, on sex or gender, on ethnicity.
Right.
And again, I'm sympathetic to states, but I'm wondering, on a theoretical basis, why states?
Because they're there.
Well, that's not necessarily a reason. Well,
no.
As a professional, I think we should keep them. But on a theoretical basis, is there something about geographic commonality that makes it preferable to concurrent majorities based on some other factor?
Excellent question. I tried to, you know, I was not trying to dismiss it. But you know, here's the point. I mean, you're absolutely correct. What is it about states qua states that deserve that kind of equality of representation? We can understand human beings from the natural right law and all of that stuff about why human beings deserve the treatment of equal treatment under, because they're human beings endowed with certain things by their creator. The creator didn't create the states. So I am in fact in considerable theoretical sympathy with you. So I'm left not at the sort of metaphysical response to why a state is a state, because I mean, my goodness, you can have tornadoes and you can have floods and you can have states being taken over and rearranged in West Virginia, all that kind of stuff. So I mean, you can have all kinds of things. So I think it reduces to a prudential question rather than a principled. And the prudential question is, one, they're there, so therefore you have to try to get rid of them. Madison, in effect, and Hamilton, in effect, try to get rid of them in the early stages, and were not successful. So, I mean, you just got to... what I mean by prudential is they're there. Why did colonies become states? They did. There's no particular natural right reason why the colonies were colonies. They were charters. So I completely agree with you that there is no metaphysical or ontological argument that one can give about states qua states that deserve representation. So I am left with a prudential argument. And there are three dimensions. One, that people were used to it, and therefore they didn't want to give it up. That's sort of a conservative argument about, why are you taking it away from us? What's wrong with them? The second argument is that is the experience of the last 200 years that if you want to have dictatorship, the way to go is administrative centralization. And a prudential reason then for states is that they provide some kind of legal protection for what we're really interested in, which is localism. We're not, in other words, the prudential case is not for states qua states. The argument is localism. And how do you protect localism? So that the third argument is, once you've moved to try to get the states in the federal structure, you also then want to move to get the states within the state structure to decentralize and not just have everything in Sacramento or New Haven. You want to really have a prudential, healthy, local, active politics. Now, that requires a certain conservatism, a conservative attachment to institutions, and a willingness of conservatives to say that conservative causal outcomes may not take place. And that's my challenge to conservatives. My challenge to liberals is that, I mean, for example, just for example, it seems to me that part of the problem, which I ratchet up with George Kerry would said in terms of kill the Constitution, but one of the things now is that it seems to me that so many issues which were once state and local are now regime questions. Is there a way in which we can tone down this kind of stuff? For example, are conservatives willing to accept the fact that abortion may be handled at the state and local level rather than at the national level, even if they get five Catholic judges in the Supreme Court who would agree with them? Are conservatives today not just attached to party? That's George. Liberals attached to party, But my learning from George Carey is maybe liberals and conservatives attached to causes, and that the cause trumps the institutions. If the cause trumps the institutions, there's no need to keep the anti-federalists alive. To keep the anti-federalists alive is to keep the institutional commitments and structure and power alive, and to then realize that causes must follow the institutions and structure rather than institutions and structure follow the causes. So will conservatives be willing to deal with that, or are they saying that abortion is of the same regime nature as slavery, which then has to be handled? You cannot have diversity between state and local. The same thing for liberals. Well, are they willing to accept to let gay marriage be settled at the state and local level? Because there are going to be at least 30 states that are going to say no. Or are they going to run to the feds and say you have to overturn this in some name of some abstract principle? Another strange, ironic way of retrieving the anti-federalist is retrieving a certain Burkean particularity, rather than this abstract, rational stuff that seems to pass for social science and judicial decision making, which seems to be totally alien to any sense of localism. I mean, it seems to run. Could African Americans vote before the 15th Amendment? The answer is yes, depending on the state and locality in which they lived. Are you telling me seriously that such a fundamental right as right to vote depends on the state and locality in which you live? Yeah. How undemocratic? How federal? Well, I understand that, but you can talk about the 15th Amendment, which trumps the 10th in certain areas. I mean, the point is that if you're going to take these powers out of the hands of the states, which, by the way, are in the Constitution because of anti-federalist thought, if you're going to take them away constitutionally. Don't take them away simply saying because it is irrational and it doesn't work in the 21st century, or that social science looks upon it as some kind of difficult model. Like, do it. What I would like to see is the return of constitutionalism to public policy. And I think the way to do that is by re-entering the anti-federalists in this debate, not to go on the line of secession, but rather to recover exactly the debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. That is, if I could summarize everything I've said tonight, is in that one line.